And we're rolling. Hey, this is Mark Goldberg with the UN Affairs blog, UN Dispatch. Today I'm talking with Dr. Joel Selinicchio, co-founder of Datadyne. Hey, Joel.
How you doing, Mark?
I should say Dr. Selinicchio, pardon me. So today we're going to talk about how cell phones are promoting public health in Africa and other sort of underdeveloped regions, because Joel is the founder of a nonprofit that sort of was set up to do just that. Maybe by sort of before we dive into this, though, I should issue a bit of a disclaimer. UN Dispatch is funded by the UN Foundation, and so is Joel's nonprofit, at least in part. So I just want to put that out there, but I don't think there are any conflict of interest here, because I'm just sort of interested in what you do and sort of how Datadyne was founded. So maybe we'll just jump right in. So I want us to know, I guess, sort of what is Datadyne and sort of what do you do?
Sure. Well, Datadyne is a small tech consultancy, a not-for-profit, and it was founded about 4 years ago by myself and Rose Donna, my partner here at Datadyne, my co-founder at Datadyne. And Rose was coming from a background of being a technology person working at American Red Cross. I was a former technology person way back after I got out of college, but more recently a physician and epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control. And I think back 4 or 5 years ago, we both had the idea around the same time that we thought we might be able to get some things accomplished as an independent organization that we were not able to get accomplished, you know, within a larger organization.
Okay. And so you founded Datadyne, and sort of there's this sort of flagship product that you put out called the Epi Surveyor. Do you want to sort of explain what that is?
Sure. I mean, we initially, I think, got started just with the idea that we thought there were ways you could apply some of the technology that was coming down the road, like PDAs and more recently like mobile phones, that we could apply these things to public health problems that we saw. So even when we were still with our previous organizations, American Red Cross and CDC, we were collaborating with groups like the Measles Initiative, which is a consortium of organizations, including UN Foundation, including CDC, et cetera, that works together toward measles vaccination. And one of the other things that that the Measles Initiative does is it has, from the very beginning, really emphasized evaluation of its own processes. For example, after you do a vaccination campaign for kids, let's say, in some sub-Saharan African country, you try to vaccinate, you know, every kid in the country over a period of some weeks. And then the question is, how do you know how effective you've been? So in those cases, you would do some kind of a large-scale survey, house-to-house survey, and you would ask people, well, you know, do you have any children that are within this age and this age, and did they get vaccinated during the recent campaign? And that's how they can come up with an estimate for, you know, let's say 97% of eligible children got vaccinated. Well, since, you know, time immemorial, this has been done on paper, but the Measles Initiative really focused on, and that was with me in my role at CDC and with Rose in her role at American Red Cross, really focused on how can we do this better? How can we adopt modern information technology to get the answers to these questions faster and more accurately than we can do on paper? And so that was kind of the first thing that we were focused on, just how can we in any way use available commercial software, commercial hardware off the shelf to make this process go better, this public health process of vaccination go better. I think once we'd started doing that, it really became a question of saying, you know, this is really valuable. We, not surprisingly, find that using computers in the field to collect health data is tremendously valuable. It's much faster, it's more accurate, you know, fewer mistakes. And that brought up an obvious question, which was, if that's the case, then why isn't everyone using this technology? And for me, in thinking about that problem, I thought, you know, I think part of the answer to this question is that it's because the software to enable, let's say, you know, if you are a public health expert and you have 30 questions in your head and you want to put them onto a PDA or now a mobile phone, the software to enable you to do that would basically require a programmer to operate it, you know, to do that for you. And, you know, by analogy,
like a professional computer programmer?
Exactly. Some kind of a consultant or programmer, et cetera. You would need some special help to be able to do that. And, you know, by analogy, I'd say, well, you know, if I asked you to take those 30 questions out of your head and type them in a word processor, Well, you know, you wouldn't certainly hire a consultant to do that. You wouldn't think that was, that wouldn't be an obstacle to your doing that process, to your engaging in that process. But if I asked you to put it on a PDA, you'd basically be stuck. If you had the money to hire a programmer, you'd be okay. And if you didn't have the money, you just wouldn't use that technology, no matter how useful it was. And, of course, this also assumes that you had the money to buy the software in the first place. So there were some, you know, obstacles. Again, you know, this, the technology was terrific, but just not easy enough for people to use. And we thought, you know, what if we can just write some kind of software, make open source software that makes it as easy to put your questions onto a PDA as it is for you to put those questions into an email or put those questions into a word processor. And that was the beginning of EbiSurveyor.
Yeah, because PDAs these days, I mean, they're pretty powerful, right? I mean, they you know, they're sort of not your granddad's cell phone, right? They can hold this kind of information.
You mean in terms of PDAs being more powerful than cell phones?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I think it's been very interesting. PDAs, of course, are sort of on the level of, let's say, to me, a PDA is basically a unconnected smartphone, right? So it's you can install your own software, you can do all that kind of stuff, and so PDAs do give you that advantage of having a more advanced operating system, let's say, than the average cell phone. On the other hand, you know, when you look at the tech trajectory of adoption of cell phones in developing countries, this is really providing a huge opportunity for us at Datadyne because though we started out working on PDA platforms, I think there's a tremendous amount of useful stuff that you can write, useful software you can write, useful projects you can do using cell phones, even now at their kind of, you know, at their kind of basic stage where, you know, it's certainly not true while cell phones are being adopted exponentially in, let's say, Sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia. It's certainly not true that most of those cell phones are smartphones. You know, a very small percentage of them are smartphones. But let's face it, any cell phone in the world right now has way more processing power than and way more memory than the computers that they use to send the Apollo astronauts to the moon. Right? I mean, any cell phone in the world today has, what, 100 times, 1,000 times more memory, more processing speed than the first IBM PC? So,
yeah.
I'm definitely with you in terms of the point of, you know, these are definitely not, you know, a typical cell phone is not a laptop computer. On the other hand, I think there's a whole lot of processing power that has just exploded on the world that we are not taking any advantage of at this point.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is you Datadyne got some sort of grant to test out sort of EpiSurveyor in the field. Is that right? You guys had a pilot project of sorts?
Yeah, well, you know, the way it's happened is we kind of, Rose and I both quit our jobs and we're doing different consulting things, you know, basically offering expertise to organizations that maybe wanted to use PDA. And we would be the consultants I mentioned before, like the programmers that would program, that would code your questions onto a PDA so you could collect data in the field. And both of us have a lot of experience with field data collection, I mean, in the most remote areas. When we quit our jobs, you know, we were doing that basically to bring some money in, but we were also trying to take some of that money and direct it toward initiating this EpiSurveyor project. We were lucky enough that we won a development marketplace grant from the World Bank initially, and that kind of got the ball rolling in terms of us being able to hire professional programmers and, you know, actually start developing a real product. And as time goes on, we've gotten funding from the UN Foundation, from the World Bank. We've gotten lots of in-kind support from the Centers for Disease Control in terms of providing staff and helping us do that. The stage that I think you're referring to is once we had a program where, you know, we had something that you could beta test, for example, we went basically on our own dime to Kenya and beta tested that with the Ministry of Health. The beta test was so promising that we got UN Foundation to agree to kick in some money to do an actual pilot. Well, first of all, to correct all the bugs that we found in the beta test, and then to do an actual pilot in Kenya and Zambia. So that was a year and something ago. And again, the pilot, we continue to show good results with the pilot. And so working with UN Foundation, funded by UN Foundation and Vodafone Group Foundation, and working with the CDC, working with the World Health Organization's African Regional Office, we actually are now in the process of rolling out EpiSurveyor with PDAs and soon with mobile phones to every country of Sub-Saharan Africa. So we've trained in about 11 countries now, and you know, it's going to be a couple more years until we're complete.
So do you have to work with sort of ministries of health in these various countries to sort of get their buy-in? And have they been sort of willing or reluctant? From their perspective, I mean, do they see the potential that you see?
Oh, people see tremendous potential. And I've never experienced anyone in one of the ministries of health as being in any way reluctant. I think, people in Africa, for example, are living through a revolution in telecommunications. I mean, you know, as amazing as it is for me to have a cell phone, it was amazing jumping for me from a situation of having lots of landlines all over the place to cell phones. For someone who didn't have lots of landlines all over the place, I mean, they're seeing really a miraculous technological transformation happening in front of them. So maybe at a level that we can't even get here, I think they really get the potential of mobile technology to do this. So, you know, to answer your first question about the Ministry of Health, yeah, of course we have to, you know, you can't just kind of go into a country and launch a project without the government of the country's kind of okay. So the Ministries of Health are really the implementing partner in all these places, and we're supporting them, getting technical assistance from the World Health Organization and from CDC. But in each of these countries, the people who are on the ground collecting the data are Ministry of Health employees.
So maybe it might be interesting if you could sort of walk us through how this works, how say the pilot program in Zambia or Kenya works. So would sort of a nurse with a cell phone walk around village to village and sort of send that data back to some central place, and what kind of data would they collect? Maybe
sure.
I'm just kind of curious of sort of what this looks like sort of on the ground.
Sure. Well, I mean, of course, one of the reasons why we thought about EpiSurveyor in the first place, we thought about developing it, was the fact that there's really an abysmally low amount of public health data, or really development data in general. So, you know, if you try to ask the question, what percentage of children are HIV positive in, you know, Namibia? The real answer is, well, no one really has any idea. Maybe a survey was done probably 3 years ago, 4 years ago. The question is, you know, how recently was it done? How large a sample of children in the country were selected? I mean, a lot of the stuff we have is it's the best we can do up to now, but it's certainly not of a quality that, let's say, a commercial enterprise would say this is good enough. I mean, you know, if you were the CEO of Toyota and you asked your chief of sales, like, how are sales doing, and they said, well, the most recent data we have is from 2005, you wouldn't be happy with that. But that's kind of the world that we live in public health. So, my point being that there's lots of public health data that needs to be collected. So in these countries, when we began doing the pilot and now the rollout in all the African countries, we had to decide, you know, we need to focus on one particular kind of data, at least to start, you know, something as a focus for the purpose of the pilot and then the rollout. And the data that we focused on was what's called supportive supervision. So in every country, let's pick Kenya. In Kenya, there are provincial level supervisors, public health officials, trained in public health, folks with college degrees and advanced training, who are in charge of basically supervising clinics within their province, you know, government-owned clinics, which is most of the clinics in most of the provinces. So these folks are supposed to go out every month, and they're supposed to provide some kind of quote-unquote supportive supervision to the people at these facilities. They're supposed to identify when the folks don't have the knowledge base they need. They're supposed to make sure the clinic is functioning properly. And in the past, a lot of that stuff was very, very general. Like, people would kind of just show up at a clinic and say, how's it going? People would say, oh, it's going pretty well. Any problems? No. And that would be kind of the extent of it. And sort of occurred to ministries of health and CDC and WHO and all the other players that it would be useful to have a standardized set of questions to be asked, a standardized form, to go out with these provincial supervisors so they would remember to ask specific questions and they'd actually gain some useful data. So they developed this form, this, you know, standardized supportive supervision form that asks questions from how many people in the clinic are, how many staff in the clinic are trained in particular levels of expertise? Have you run out of your anti-malarial medicines within the last couple months? This kind of thing. And that was the focus of the pilot. So let's go back to Kenya. In Kenya, folks came in for 3 days of training. taught how to use a PDA, a Palm operating system PDA.
And these are local nurses and health technicians.
Right. These are what are called provincial level public health officers. So they're folks again with a college degree, not doctors, typically not nurses, not clinical people, but public health people. And they're sort of clinic supervisors. And they came in for 3 days of training. They were provided with EpiSurveyor. And I think one of the critical points, which really played out later, was that they were provided not with one form, not with the supportive form and said, here, go collect this data with us. They were given that form, but they were given it with EpiSurveyor, which meant that they were able to create any new forms that they might need in the future. So it's not the same thing as handing them one form. It's basically giving them a forms development toolkit that's easy enough for even, folks that are not technically minded to use. Because these are people who, they've used Microsoft Word and that kind of thing, but they're certainly not programmers. They're average folks like you and me. And
well, you're a programmer.
I can't even call myself that because I was a programmer a long, long time ago.
Yeah,
none of my programmer friends would recognize me as a programmer.
Yeah.
They think I'm a nice guy, but definitely not a programmer.
Mm-hmm.
So in any case, back in Kenya, folks would get this training and they'd go out in the field and they start collecting that data. Well, that's great. They're collecting data for that supportive supervision. And again, that's a good step in the right direction. But what was even more kind of hopeful and what really, I think, validated the whole idea of EpiSurveyor, again, as being a toolkit for forms creation and for data collection rather than one specific data collection project, is that people quickly realized that this was a much easier way to collect data when they needed to collect data than using paper. And so when in Kenya now, when an outbreak occurs, let's say, of polio, and when that happens, people need to go in the field and collect information about the cases, who seems to have it, when do they develop it? They develop a whole database of information about this. It's data collection. And without us having anything to do with it, without them even telling us not telling us until after the fact, they took their PDAs, they took the EpiSurveyor software, and they took their old form, the paper form for collecting outbreak investigations data, and they transferred it to the PDA. And now they do all their outbreak investigations electronically on the PDA.
Did that actually happen? That there was sort of a polio outbreak?
Oh, yeah.
Sort of Kenyan officials identified early because of this PDA?
They didn't identify the outbreak. The outbreak was identified, but once, if you identify a kid, polio, the symptoms of polio are paralysis or weakness. And so if you identify a kid who's got that, in a country like Kenya, which really has polio basically on the run, they're close to getting polio out of Kenya entirely through vaccination programs. And so when you identify a kid who you think might have polio, it's a real public health emergency. You want to make sure to stamp out that fire as quick as you possibly can. And that means basically tracing the contacts of that kid. That means doing lab tests on all the people who might have been connected to that kid or come in contact with them. It means vaccinating a group of people. And a large part of this is keeping track of a database of potential contacts and contacts. And so, again, EpiSurveyor wasn't used to identify the outbreak. It was used to conduct the investigation afterwards. And then they do an emergency outbreak vaccination campaign, again, trying to vaccinate everyone who might have come in contact with that kid. And when they do that, they have to do a coverage survey afterwards to determine, did we vaccinate most of the kids that we tried to vaccinate? We wanted to get 100% of potential contacts. Did we get 100%? Or was it 60%? Or was it 90%? And so for all those different data-intensive activities, they, on their own initiative, used EpiSurveyor, which to me sort of demonstrates that, one, they clearly see the utility of it. Two, it is, in fact, simple enough for them to do completely on their own without any foreign consultants coming in, which was the whole previous model. The whole previous model was you want to collect something on a mobile device, you need to go and hire some, programmer from Europe or the United States, which obviously is a barrier to the adoption of that technology.
Yeah, that's the whole point of it being an open source kind of programming.
Yep.
That sort of anyone with any sort of degree of programming knowledge could sort of improve upon the current model.
Right. Go ahead.
No, you go.
But, well, I was going to say that there's kind of two aspects to that. One is just the simplicity of the program. So even if EpiSurveyor was a closed source program, like say Microsoft Word, Microsoft Word, anybody can use it. I mean, it's not difficult to use. So yeah. It's way easier, let's say, than, you know, word processors were 15 years ago. I'm trying to remember if we had word processors 15 years ago. But it's way easier than those, than that model. People have made it so it's approachable and usable by just an average person who's got average skills. So that's, you know, one thing is just having an easy program, regardless of whether it's open source. The open source factor really comes in because, you know, as you say, what we've wanted is for anybody who's got the skills and the desire to be able to go in and look at that code, modify that code, and add features to the software. And we've actually had that happen. There's an organization called Aptivate, which is a nonprofit developer based in Cambridge in the UK. They were apparently using EpiSurveyor to do HIV data collection in Zambia. Again, you know, unbeknownst to us, they just downloaded it from the website. Mm-hmm. And they called us to let us know. They said, you know, we had some features that you guys didn't have in EpiSurveyor, and we wanted to know if you're planning on adding them anytime soon. They told me the features, all, you know, interesting stuff, but not our priorities at the moment. And so we said, you know, that's really not our priority. We'll put it on our list of features to be added, but I can tell you it's not, you know, it's not going to be in our top 10. And they said, well, you know, we're developers also, so would it be okay for us to go ahead and add those features and then just later give you back the code? And we're like, yeah, that's exactly right. What we want to happen.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, that's a beautiful model.
So you said earlier that sort of next steps is sort of expanding. So EpiSurveyor is currently, you said, in two countries?
EpiSurveyor is in 11 countries under the official rollout. Right,
okay.
So 11 sub-Saharan African countries. But EpiSurveyor is being used by lots of other organizations, you know, Hopkins School of Public Health, you know, WHO in different areas, CDC in different areas, Aptivate, the organization I just mentioned. And that's, you know, not under our sort of supervision, but we're quite happy that folks are using it.
I'm wondering, sir, was the recent outbreak of political violence in Kenya, how did that affect the program at all?
Well, it brought large parts of the program to a complete standstill, just for safety reasons. Yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, they couldn't travel, not safe to leave your house, and I mean, you know, public health and medical activities, all that stuff comes to a standstill if people can't you know, safely move from one place to another.
Yeah, but I guess you mentioned earlier, sir, that there's a sort of this mobile phone revolution sort of happening in Africa right now. And I remember sort of hearing sort of when the violence broke out in Kenya that sort of Kenyans, sort of more than most other African countries, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, are plugged in with their mobile phones. I even read a report that they often pay taxis using sort of cell phone credits.
Well, I think every sub-Saharan African country, every developing country in the world, people are, they are, you know, surgically attached to their mobile phones. This is a, you know, they get the fact it's very useful. I mean, it's very hard to find somebody, let's say within the city of Nairobi, you know, the capital city of Kenya. It's very hard to find somebody in Nairobi that doesn't have at least two cell phones, one for each of the two major providers there. So they're, they are big cell phone users, big SMS users, more than in this country, much more than in this country, because it's cheaper and they don't want to have to pay for voice, basically.
I mean, do you see any sort of dark side to being this sort of this plugged in politically unstable? in politically unstable countries, one could imagine that sort of this, it would be very easy to activate a lot of people to do harm.
I think that's the case with any of these kind of, you know, I mean, the phone in general. I mean, it helps people to organize for good, helps people to organize for bad. I mean, we definitely saw that. I mean, actually, probably the best case of that would be Rwanda. In Rwanda, the radio stations, you know, the cell phones were used for to mobilize people to kill their neighbors. But, you know, I mean, that's the nature of technology. It's not, you know, cell phones don't kill people. People kill people.
Yeah. But in general, this revolution, I mean, it is truly sort of transforming how Africans sort of connect and speak to each other.
You know, I mean, you're reaching a point where every person on the planet in the foreseeable future is going to be able to send a message to every other person on the planet. And I think you can see the potential benefits of that. I think you can see the potential chaos of that. the potential, you know, misuses of that. I mean, you know, when cell phone spam gets worse than it is now, I mean, none of us is going to be very happy. But yeah, it is for the first time, basically, you are bringing computing to, and that's what it is. I mean, that's what we're talking about, mobile computers. You're bringing mobile computers to the rest of the world's population. And it's, I don't think, you know, like the printing press, like electricity, like the telegraph, I don't think that we can even really begin to understand that the changes that are going to happen in society as a result of this kind of explosion. I mean, when I hear people sort of saying, oh, this cell phone, you know, explosion of cell phones is great, now people can call each other. You know, that's kind of a typical tech misconception. People see a new technology and they assume what it will be used to do is simply emulate what we did with the old technology. Like, these are phones, so now we can make more phone calls. Which is kind of like, you know, you're standing watching Gutenberg demonstrate the printing press and you're thinking, well, what's the big deal? Now we can print more books. You know, well, you know, the big deal is printing more books is going to cause, let's see, the Protestant Reformation, you know, wars across Europe, the rise and fall of nations, mass education, democracy. I mean, you know, all those things stem from that activity, and I think we're looking at something that is really, I was going to say potentially, but I'll just say really is, I believe, at least as transformative as that.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like, sir, we don't, sir, I guess maybe we in the West don't get it, because we have all these other sort of available technologies.
Yeah, I think that's really the case. And, you know, it's funny because I'll go to conferences with public health people, and they don't know a whole lot about technology generally, and they're kind of receptive and interested. I'll go to technology conferences out in, say, Silicon Valley, and, you know, I was talking to, I was giving a talk out at a conference out there, and there was a tech guy out there who said, well, but, you know, current cell phones are, I can't remember the word he used, but basically was indicating that they're just, you know, they're not a capable development platform. You're very limited in the kind of programs you can write to run on a cell phone. And I, you know, I said, well, I'm not just talking about writing programs for cell phones. I mean, the fact is that you can send an SMS message now from anywhere in the world to Google's SMS number and get the weather for any city in the world. That means all of a sudden, every person in rural Africa who's got a cell phone can get the weather report for the first time. Every person in rural Vietnam with a cell phone, which is many of the people in rural Vietnam, can now get weather reports, do Google searches, send messages to their relatives in distant places. I mean, and this is using really the lowest common denominator of cell phone functionality, which is SMS. You know, people will say, well, SMS is limited. It's only got, 160 characters, and it's limited by this, and it's limited by that. You know, I've never heard anybody kind of think about, well, you know, your keyboard, I mean, you know, what's the RAM of your keyboard? You know, what's the processing power of your mouse? Like, nobody ever thinks about that. And to me, I think of a cell phone, at least at this early stage, and I think it's going to get much more involved and much more miraculous, but I think at this stage, even if we just look at SMS and look at SMS as being an input-output device to the Internet, the fact that billions more people, billions of the poorest people on Earth, now have access to, you know, text searches of the Internet. They now have an input device and an output device for the Internet and all the information that's stored on there. Well, maybe not the video information or the picture information yet, but just the text information. I mean, that is an enormous change. And as I said, I don't think we've even begun to come close to appreciating the difference. And it may be that folks out in Silicon Valley are maybe the least well-positioned to kind of see this coming, because they're so submerged in, they're so immersed, I should say, in, you know, in Web 3.0 and all the stuff that's coming down the pike, all this terrific stuff that I use. But again, I think it kind of blinds them to the value that something as simple as SMS can provide.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like sort of they're putting more effort into sort of this, you know, so Web 3.0 and these other things than to really developing cell phone technology as well. And sort of it seems that sort of they're almost creating their own sort of scenario in which the cell phone remains sort of like the second cousin to the powerful laptop.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. And the fact is, sure, you know, technology always flows downhill, right? I mean, right now, most people, let's say, and most of those people I mentioned in Nairobi don't have a smartphone. You know, they have a basic cell phone or two basic cell phones. But, of course, you know, that technology, I mean, how many years before the people walking around Nairobi are carrying the equivalent of an iPhone. 2 years, yeah. 3 years, 5 years. So eventually, the fruits of the labors of these folks in Silicon Valley, I think, will roll downhill to these people in developing countries. I guess what I'm trying to say to folks is there's stuff that we could be doing now that's tremendously useful just using just the basic technology that's available now. Everyone in rural villages in Kenya having a cell phone is like we were able to just suddenly string a telegraph line to every one of those villages. Now, it's still the telegraph. I mean, we know it's limited, right? It's a telegraph. It's not a high-speed video link, but it's something. You know, it's something that you can actually work with, and it's way better than nothing. And I think, you know, to me, that's almost like the niche that we're exploiting here at Datadyne right now. We're very interested in web-based stuff, very interested in the high-end stuff that's being developed. Personally, I use this stuff all the time. But at the same time, we're really interested in exploiting, you know, right now, today, this really bottom-of-the-pyramid kind of technology, this lowest common denominator stuff. Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably sort of as much time as we have, but thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Dr. Selinikio. We'll put a link up to Datadyne and a few of the sort of report from the pilot project up on the site. Thanks so much.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Mark.